sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Crude surges as the OPEC ministers cry wolf. Market hits a high and then ease from the all-time high as economic data softens, while big box retailers have a great week. And our guest, Vitaly Katsanelson, value investor extraordinaire, is our guest today. All this and much more on episode number 471 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Yeah, it was an interesting week. I hope you had a good week. This is Andrew Horowitz, episode number 471. We're talking now. It's the middle of August 2016, and while we've seen a tremendous, and I mean a tremendous drop-off in volume, almost to levels that we've seen usually pre-holiday of the last few weeks, really just a lack of enthusiasm, even though we're seeing markets do well. We did see some nice moves on the volume side of things after the employment numbers came out. But before that, and now after that, volumes are just light. There could be a lot of reasons why that's happening. Maybe it's because of the share buybacks. Maybe so many shares have been bought back already that there's just not a lot of shares out there to be traded. Maybe it's a lot about this index investing. Now, a great article I saw over the weekend was the amount of money that has come out of active investing equity-style mutual funds has been pretty much taken and moved right into index investing. So if we're looking at a lot of players, investors, putting their money into index funds, passive investing styles, maybe what's happening here is there's just a I don't care attitude. Put the money in, let it sit for 10, 15 years. I'm not going to trade it anymore. I'm not going to deal with these markets and this really quick moves down, really quick moves up. I'm not going to try to time. I'm just going to let it sit there and bake. And maybe a lot of investors at this point have pretty much just thrown in the towel. Maybe it's just apathy. Maybe it's just the summertime. Maybe it's just index investing. Whatever the case may be, still we're finding that there is this significant lack of volume. And I find that interesting, not necessarily telling us anything in particular. You add that to the VIX being sub 12, very much on the low side of historical averages. You know, a lot of people look at 15 as a level that the VIX, the fear index, the volatility index, that's the level that a lot of people look at. 18, 19 is really the historical, long-term historical average for the VIX. There's some discussion that there's been a lot of options buying into the VIX on the call side on the 22s and 24s out towards the end of September, which coincides with the next possible rate hike. Quotes around that, italics, question mark, squigglies, the rate hike that the Fed has been saying may be on the table for the end of the year. There's a lot of banter back and forth. We know this. We've seen this. We've been watching this. You've been seeing this. You know, there's one Fed official that says, we think that we're going to be two or three rate hikes by the end of the year. The economy warrants that. It looks like it's going to happen. Then somebody comes out and says, well, you know, I don't think there's going to be one for the next 2 years. It goes back and forth, these trial balloons that are thrown out there. Noise, simple noise, let it go. Don't worry about it. Don't listen to it. Unimportant, just information to absorb, put into your process, your thinking, but not acting upon it at this point because the Fed, we know the Fed's been very dovish. At every step of the way, along this entire run from 2008 to now, the Fed has been pretty much in a wait-and-see attitude. I think that rate hike they did at the beginning of the year or the end of last year was pretty much just a way of gauging the level of concern that markets will have, because again, the focus that the Fed has on the markets is pretty much more than ever. Let's put it that way. But the VIX being sub 12, showing a lack of concern about any volatility, very tight ranges. As a matter of fact, Tom McClellan wrote about some of the tightest ranges in history for markets. While we did see markets reach an all-time high, no question about that, it was, again, on some volume that was lackluster. But still, it did, you know, price is important. It did reach an all-time high. But the question is, what is all of the underlying things telling us? That there's more index investing, there's a lot of apathy, just, you know, non-concern, a lack of concern about volatility with the VIX being so low, meaning nobody's really out there actively hedging in a big way and buying up and pushing up the VIX. So I thought it was really interesting in the daily letter and the weekly letter that Tom McClellan wrote about some of the divergences that have been going on recently, the new highs that have been reached, peaked in the mid part of July and started to move down recently. We're seeing that the McClellan oscillator is on the negative side of things. Interesting. VIX being so low. You have to wonder. You just have to, for a second, just sit back and say, are we going to just continue going up? And for what reason? Valuations? No. Central banks? Yes. Low interest rates? Well, yeah. Okay, that's good too. Tina, there is no other alternative. Well, there's no alternative. There is no alternative to investing. Sovereign wealth funds. I mean, a lot of different things that go into that, because the big question is, what are people buying? And it looks like they're just buying the index, which goes in line with our discussion about why we're seeing that all-time highs are reached, with the idea that at the same time, a lot of money is coming out of active or quote-unquote stock-picking type of strategies and moving into index or passive strategies. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Now, we did see some stocks moving, some things that really surprisingly moved down at the rate that they did over the last year or so. We're talking about Macy's, Kohl's, JCPenney will throw in there, Sears, Dillard's. These are stocks that have been obliterated with the thought that there's a new mentality, a new process, a new way of consumers shopping. They're not going to the big box retailers. They're doing online shopping. They're doing alternative type, or maybe not shopping at all for some, actually retail sales last week. We'll get to some of the numbers in a minute, but retail sales last week disappointed dramatically. But I think some of the big box retailers got the point. Macy's closing down 100 stores, changing around some of the ways they market and sell. Stocks jumped like 15, 18%. Dillard's was the one laggard and all that. But again, Macy's and Kohl's really did a marvelous job of moving. We saw also some other stocks like Shake Shack. I've been mentioning that we're short that position, down 10% after lackluster growth. Same store sales missed. And just generally speaking, even with more stores opening, not a lot of excitement in terms of the growth. And that makes a lot of sense because there's so much competition out there right now. I mean, we're seeing that. Of course, we know that for a long time, the big thing was the Mexican chains. We saw Chipotle, of course, just rise to unbelievable levels and then just get harpooned after the whole E. coli incident. Now we're seeing competition coming in. Jack in the Box is seemingly taking a lot of the customers away from Chipotle and some of the other smaller chains that deal with Mexican. And even, you see, Burger King is coming out with the Whopper Burrito or the Whopperito or something like that. A Whopper Burrito. They're coming out with a Whopper Burrito. I'm not sure how that's going to go over, but it's interesting. And then again, I guess if the McRib could be popular, I suppose this could be something exciting as well. The Whopper Burrito. Same thing, just kind of wrapped in a different wrapper. Mushed up a little bit. Going to be interesting. Anybody had that Whopper Burrito? I want to know about that. Hit me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz, one word, about the Whopper Burrito. All right, let's see what else. All right, so I want to talk about the some of the weekly economic things that are going on, the earnings, et cetera. We did see that retail sales weakened. July was the first month since March without a gain in U.S. retail purchases. The latest report showed that retail sales were flat for the month, which was kind of disappointing in the wake of the nice move, well, at least the the nice move from the aspect of that retail sales are pretty stagnant. You know, we're not seeing 10% moves. We're talking about 0.8%. Car and truck sales advanced 1.1% during the month. But if you take out auto buying, retail sales were actually down 0.3% for the month. We also saw that the University of Michigan's monthly consumer sentiment survey, it rose to about 90.4. But this is, again, a level that has been dropping ever so slowly, just gingerly moving lower. Looks like sentiment is starting to wane a little bit. The other thing that I thought was really interesting last week was the PPI. I don't know if you saw this, but the PPI number came in at a 0.4 to the minus. PPI fell in June. Remember when the last month the number came up and it was a pretty hot number and everybody was thinking that, hey, inflation is possibly here? We're starting to see some indication that on the wholesale level and on the consumer level, there's some inflation going on here. But no, it fell off pretty hard here, and we're back to the possibility of having an economy with great employment, no GDP growth, and no inflation, if not deflation, continuing. And we did see oil rally. I don't know if you noticed on Thursday into Friday, there was this big rally. It dropped off on Wednesday after the Department of Energy came out with their numbers and we saw a big build. All of a sudden, the Saudi oil ministers came out with some kind of a headline comment that, you know what, they're going to do what they can to make sure that prices are sustained and that they have, they're going to do something. Who knows what, but something. Big mystery. This is the third time now. This is the third time we've seen the same situation when oil starts coming down very hard that all of a sudden OPEC pipes up with, hey, you know what? We got to do something. And they have meetings and excitement into it, and oil comes up into it, and all of a sudden, the meeting's over. And what do? Nothing, because they can't. They have too many divergences inside of OPEC and too many countries that are opposing each other in the process. They have to keep pumping in order to make sure they have enough money. They can't slow down their overall production. So kind of interesting. We have a couple of things happening in terms of earnings next week. And right after that, we talk about this. We're going to get to our guest, Vitaly. We have, first of all, on Tuesday, we're going to have the July CPI come out. We're going to see building permits, industrial output, Dick's Sporting Goods, Advanced Auto Parts, Home Depot, TJX, Urban Outfitters. Now, Wednesday, we're going to see the minutes from the July Federal Reserve policy meeting and earnings from American Eagle Outfitters, Cisco, L Brands, which you need to watch that because it seems like they're slowing down a bit. Lowe's, NetEase, Staples, and Target. We'll see some initial claims, some more employment numbers on Thursday. And then on Friday, we're going to see Deere. Actually, Thursday, we're also going to see Walmart. But we're going to see Deere, Estee Lauder, Foot Locker, Steinmart, and a couple other retailers coming out. It's going to be interesting. But anyway, going to be an interesting week to watch what's going on here in terms of some of the final numbers of the earnings report for this season. And then we'll start getting towards a wrap-up of how many beat and how many missed and the estimates for next quarter and all that good stuff. But anyway, let's get to our guest, and I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about some of my interesting takeaways from a meeting I had, or a conference, mini-conference, very small 20, 30 people in a room with Larry Williams. He was speaking here. He came into Florida and had a small event with TradeStation, which I was asked to be a part of. And I thought it was very interesting, some of the things that he talked about in terms of cycles and what's going to be happening in September. So stick around to listen to that. In the meantime, by the way, any questions you have, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can send me an email. Ask me anything you want, of course, and the show notes and information on what we talk about on the show and on the various shows over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And our guest today, Vitaly Katsanelson. You know, you've heard of him before on our show, and you probably have seen him out there writing some great articles and doing some great work. You can find him at imausa.com. Also writes The Contrarian Edge. We'll talk about some deep value, some value orientation. Vitaly, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. It's been a long time.
I know.
Well, I want to talk about, you know, to me, you're known as, I don't know, you know, I don't want to put a moniker on it, but a deep value and value-oriented investor. And I, one of the questions that comes up to me these days is with the market seeing some pretty significant moves off of any particular news, not backing down, kind of having one of those, you know, bulldog kind of things where it doesn't matter what the news is, doesn't matter what the negative side of things is. The market's just like, hey, give me more. Come on, I can take it. And stocks reaching some high levels in terms of historic valuations. How are you finding good value these days?
I think it's been incredibly difficult. And I think the key today is when you don't find value is to be kind of humble and patient.
Humble and patient. What does that mean? What does that mean? Because most investors are cocky and impatient.
Well, okay, so you need to be humble because we are investing today in probably one of the most difficult environments ever, because we have no idea how the economy is going to look 1, 3, or 5 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people are celebrating that the stock market is making new highs, but one thing you have to understand is that one quarter of global debt yields negative interest rates, which I can't even explain what it actually means.
you and I both. I have, you know, the whole thought of negative interest rates. I understand the basic premise of it from a central bank standpoint, but the whole idea of it is so not only bizarre, but what we can see initially from the reaction to these negative interest rates is that it's not a good thing.
Well, it's an act of desperation. I mean, when you have negative interest rates, it basically tells you that the central banks are trying very, very hard to avoid deflation. But even like on the you and I studied economics, but anything you and I studied in the past is irrelevant, because like just think about the concept of interest rates. I saved up $100 because I did not go to restaurants or whatever, you know, and so I gave up consumption. So I'm lending you this money, and in a year you're going to give me $105, yep. $5 interest, and $5 interest is going to be kind of my pay for giving up consumption.
Mm-hmm.
With negative interest rates, so basically I sacrificed, and for the sacrifice you get $5. With negative interest rates, what it means basically, I sacrifice my consumption, and a year later I get $5 less.
Right.
It makes no rational sense.
But it makes sense. It makes sense for the governments who are obviously looking to protect their book. I mean, I look at this whole thing, and I don't want to go into this whole detail about the central banks. Talk about more about value, but it looks to me as if the governments, as they are in control of pricing, they're looking to protect their book, which is essentially treasuries on a that they have outstanding, and as such, they don't want to have. But on the other hand, you have to wonder, well, who in their right mind is putting money to work at a negative rate? That doesn't make any sense at all.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The reason I'm bringing this up is that you have a lot of people today that celebrating the stock market. The stock market is making new highs. And what all I'm trying to say is that it's making new highs, not because the economy is doing great, but because underneath is doing horrible. Because investors are basically forced into risky assets, and stocks are a risky asset because they have no alternatives. And therefore, you have to, the outcomes down the road, not today or maybe even tomorrow, but down the road, we have no idea how it's going to play out. And even saying the words, I don't know, you probably don't have many guests that say this on your podcasts, but that's what I call, that's what I mean by humility. And therefore, if you don't know, you're going to structure your portfolio where you may have a kind of bipolar outcomes. Either, you have inflation, like just a simple example. You can have inflation or deflation. And if you position your portfolio only for, if you have a very firm opinion that you're going to have inflation, you're going to position your portfolio in a certain way. And if you have a very strong opinion that you're going to have deflation, you're going to do completely opposite. What I'm saying is you kind of want to position yourself, well, I don't know, for both outcomes. And that means, you know, in my mind, it means humility, because you're saying, I don't know, and I'm going to try to, and I'm going to try to position my portfolio for this kind of I don't know outcomes. That comes to humility. About patience, it also means that when you have nothing smart to do, when you don't have anything good to buy at good prices, when you don't sacrifice on quality or you don't sacrifice on valuation, you basically do nothing, which in my mind means you hold cash. That's what I mean by patience.
You know, it's interesting because this is an argument that seems to be right in line with the whole reason for, at least this argument, diversification. And what I mean by that is we've done some studies and we've looked back a number of years, the last 2 years, not this year, but the last 2 years, the whole concept of traditional diversification didn't work. The whole idea that if you were going to get market returns, the only place that you really could have been around the world mm-hmm. in the last couple of years was the S&P 500 mm-hmm. or, you know, values, high dividend blue chips or something like that. That was the place in which you would get decent returns. The rest of the world was terrible. Mm-hmm. Now, this year, all things changed. Diversification looks great. If you have some commodities, you have some bonds, you have large caps, small caps, domestic, international, equities, et cetera, that is looking really, really good, because diversification, not that it came back in vogue, like somebody pushed a button and said, yes, diversification will do well, but this is back to your humility and patience discussion, is that if you don't know and we're not quite sure, and if you don't have a particular a direction, you say, well, you know, the stock market is going to crash. The stock market's going to do really well. Bonds are going to crash. Bonds are going to do really well. But you kind of spread it out a little bit right now. That's what's paying off.
You're probably right. From my perspective, you know, clients come to us and say, here's my portfolio, invest it for us wisely. Here's my money, invest for it wisely. We are trying to find kind of value stocks globally, and we have a hard time finding high quality companies that we can buy at good prices. So the new accounts that come to us today would be maybe 20-25% invested in stocks. And this is not a market timing decision. This is, you know, we have a huge watch list of stocks that you'd like to buy, but at different prices. And I think this is where patience comes in. We're basically saying we may get a chance. I mean, I may look dumb like an idiot for if the market melts up 20% higher, and I'm fine with that.
And it's interesting. Let me give you the opposite side. So if we call your style value, let's just leave a big tag on it called value. Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. And if we call one of my strategies growth, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. But in particular, the stocks that we pick have to have earnings growth mm-hmm. that are consecutive over time. We have to have revenue growth. We have to have expanding margins. You know, a very not typical, but we use a lot of different things to mm-hmm. find stocks that meet this criteria. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that, and this was probably you would say, well, that makes sense. But what's interesting is that we've had some of the lowest number of stocks come through that screen over mm-hmm. the last 2 years, 2.5 years, than we've seen in a while. Now, recently, there was a bit of a pickup. We went from about 35, 36 stocks. We saw 40 stocks. I just ran it this morning, mm-hmm. and we have 50 stocks that came through that screen. Now, that there's a little bit of noise in there, but let's assume that right now that 50 is compared to our top end that we see when things are really good and you can find really good growth opportunities. It was like 75. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing on the growth side as the value side. It's very difficult to find those companies that are making certain really high quality numbers. Now, but let's talk about the value side. What do you consider? If people are listening, you know, they're like, well, we're talking about value, talking about growth. You know, what is your consideration for a value stock? And what is then something that you would look at as a criteria of, okay, this is valued well, I'm going to buy it?
Okay, so Andrew, this is where the discussion gets incredibly complicated, and let me explain you why. Because I may be buying your growth stocks and consider them to be value, and here, you know, and so I wrote this article about this just maybe a few weeks ago. So basically, when we look at stocks, we look at them from three dimensions. You have a high quality company, that would be quality dimension. So it's a company that has good management, good balance sheet, etc. Then you have a growth dimension where basically earnings growth and dividends. So if you add quality and growth together, you have a good company.
Mm-hmm.
And the valuation, it's kind of the discount of what this company is worth, makes it a good stock.
So it's like a GARP, we call it, growth at a reasonable price concept?
Well, not necessarily. So it could be, but what I'm trying to say is this. If you have a company that's growing earnings at a very fast pace, then it will never look statistically cheap. Just to throw some numbers around, let's say a company that trades at 8 times earnings looks statistically cheap.
Okay.
Company that trades at 15 times earnings, I'm just making this up, may look statistically expensive. Mm-hmm. But what you may find that if you have a company that's a kind of a crappy business, over leveraged, and the earnings are not growing and declining, it may trade at 8 times earnings, which looks statistically cheap, but may actually be an expensive stock.
Right.
Because guess what? It's worth 6 times earnings, really.
Right.
And then you have a company that's growing earnings, and it can continue to grow earnings for a long period of time, has great management, has a strong competitive advantage, and it trades at 15 times earnings, and it may be cheap because 5 years, if I have a very good confidence that 5 years from now its earnings will double or triple, then it's actually not trading at 15 times earnings, but maybe trading at 8 times or 7 times future earnings.
Right, this
is why I've been put into value camp, and I am, I wrote this article called "The Values of Value Investing," where I argue is that value investors are basically traditionally be put into category of people who buy statistically cheap stocks, and I think that's how Warren Buffett started his career, but Warren Buffett migrated over time. When he saw a company that has a long growth runway, he would buy it even though it would not look statistically cheap. And so it's really, the value investing is really about the values of value investing. It's really about looking at stocks not as a piece of paper, but as businesses. It's looking for a margin of safety. I think that's what really value investing is about, not just buying stock that trades at 10 times earnings.
And when it comes to value investing and looking for that margin of safety, dividends obviously provide somewhat of a slight backstop on some of that, which is used in your calculations, right?
Yes. So dividends, I look at dividends, if we go back to the kind of the growth and quality framework, they are part of the growth framework because they're part of the return, right? So if company is growing earnings 10% a year and pays you 5% dividend, your growth dimension gives you 15% rate there.
Mm-hmm.
But they also are very important on the quality dimension because they create a tangible cost for management. Usually management does not like to cancel dividends.
Right, because
it's a very big decision. Mm-hmm. So therefore, when a company has a significant dividend payout, they have to manage the business. It creates another kind of quality check on the management, I guess.
So is one of the problems that you're having right now is the incredible debt load that companies have recently put on their books? I mean, we have seen that over the last number of years because of the restructuring of debt over time to take it from, let's just say, an 8% number down to a 4% number on corporate debt issuance, where they're paying a lot less, but they stacked it. I mean, now that we're seeing that there's more corporate debt outstanding, I think, than ever right now.
That's right. And I think if you look historically, corporations are the worst capital allocators when it comes to buying back stock. They buy huge amount of their stock at the top. And they don't buy, when the market crashes, they never buy their stock. So the point is that a lot of companies over the last many, many years have been buying their stock by leveraging their balance sheets. And we really don't like that. I don't like when companies increase their debt just to buy back stock.
But the markets like it.
Well, they like it today.
Yeah,
and I'm not investing for today. I'm investing for the future. And if in the scenario where interest rates rise, that's not going to be good for them.
So tell me something. So what does happen? So interest rates rise, time goes on. I mean, they're when interest rates rise, they're still, they don't have to issue more debt. They're still at the moment for long-term debt issuance, if it's not rolling in the near term, they still have a significant amount of time on their hands where they can keep that going. But one of the things that concerns me is we have been seeing a consistent, you know, a slowdown in revenue, right? Mm-hmm. Sales. Mm-hmm. Earnings beat, but, you know, we know the game with earnings beats. And we look at the Goldman Sachs that, you know, they beat by 63 cents because analysts took them down from 375 down to $3 and they beat it by 65 cents, right? So, wow, that's great. That's very exciting. But we know that the earnings game on EPS can be adjusted. There's a lot of things that the companies can do to beat their numbers. They can do buybacks, which shrink their float. We know all that. But what happens if revenues continue to slow? And let's just say, for the argument here for a moment, that revenues slow down precipitously due to some event. I don't know what it is. Something happens, okay? And all of a sudden, they have all this debt on the books. Is this going to be like a double whammy for companies for earnings?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. So today's corporate margins are at, I mean, maybe slightly off their all-time highs, but still incredibly high. When revenues slow down, the margins will get compressed. And now they added another layer of cost by borrowing more money. So that will add, you know, that will be the double whammy, right? That, because that will compress margins even more,
right?
Because the costs are higher. You know, the interest expense is another cost. The stocks that kind of worry me, like if you, let's say, interest rates go up, the stocks that worry me are the kind of those bond substitutes. Like, and I put them into two tiers. Like one tier would be like the Coca-Colas of the world, you know, where people basically buying, and I have nothing against Coke, but this is a good example. People are paying 23 times earnings for 3% dividend. And they say this 3% dividend is better than the treasury yield. I agree 100%. And people say, well, this is a high-quality business, so that dividend will not go away anytime soon. I agree there as well. But you're paying 23 times earnings for this dividend. At some point, if rates go up, and at some point they may, people will say, well, actually, 23 times earnings is actually kind of a lot. And suddenly, people will discover that they were basically buying a bond, and they were paying significant premium to what it's, you know, a bond that has a par of 100 and they were paying 130 or 140.
Right.
That's what those stocks look like. But it gets worse. If you have another category of stocks, like I put like master limited partnerships and those kind of deflated already, or real estate investment trusts that people were buying solely for the yield, but those companies were also levered. You know, they had a lot of debt on the balance sheet because those businesses don't function well without a lot of debt. So interest rates go up. So the valuation of these companies will get re-rated, but also their financing costs will go up as well. And suddenly their earnings are lower, And so that group of stocks worries me even more.
But the question, as I guess, is, and this is something that we probably, back to the I don't know, what would make interest rates go up? Because right now the central banks seem very market-centric. You know, it seems that they have their various mandates, but the mandates have been thrown right out the window. And if interest rates go up and markets go down, doesn't that mean that the other side kicks in, that interest rates go down again because they get concerned? Let's look what happened with Brexit.
Uh-huh.
Brexit was an event that everybody was concerned about, a liquidity situation due to the fact that the uncertainties, blah, 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 blah. Central banks stood up ahead of Brexit and said, you know what, we'll make sure there's enough liquidity. In fact, they flushed the markets with liquidity, which I think some of the after effects we're still feeling right now with the extra monies in the markets. We see a lowering of interest rates and a new start to QE by the Bank of England. Here, they're being very dovish. That was a market event. That was not an economic event because nothing happened. An economic event would be post-Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
We see a slowdown in GDP, in hiring, in manufacturing, blah, 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 blah. That would be playing out over a couple of different months, several different months in a row, let's say, and looking not very well. Not a one-day vote event looking into the future. But meanwhile, central banks were so worried about markets that they turned around and flushed money in. And that's why markets seem to have picked up just a few days later, realizing that, hey, wait a minute, this whole thing isn't going to play out for 2 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so central banks have kind of gone off the rails a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And have gone, you know, to a point that has been almost to a crazy level of market, you know, even though they deny this, that they are very market centric. So if the if interest rates go up, markets come down, you know, the old the tantrum that we've heard about, what's going to make interest rates go back up again? I just find them almost an impossible circumstance until maybe sometime much later in the future.
Well, I mean, so my gut feeling tells me that in the short run, the interest rates in the United States may actually decline. But I would not make any investment decisions on what I'm about to tell you, you know, what I just told you. And the only reason I have this feeling because the global, you know, we have negative interest rates everywhere else but the United States. And I think you may import lower interest rate, you know, but the capital flows. So investors in Germany say, well, you know what? Yeah, I would rather buy American bonds because they're still yielding something. And so, in the short run, it may drive our rates lower. But in the long run, you know, the reason we may have high interest rates because central banks may not necessarily, you know, may lose control over interest rates because the market forces and then they will start, you know, setting interest rates. And if that happens, then let me give you this, I guess, you may look at Japan. It's one of the most, third or fourth largest economy in the world. It's the most levered economy. It has a very old population. It's 10-year bond.
It's a dead economy.
It's a dead economy. It has negative interest rates.
Right.
At some point, they will have to inflate themselves out of the problems they're having because they just have too much debt. So the government is going to have to issue a lot of debt. And when this happens, this may be a wake-up call for bond investors, which would say, oh my God, you may actually have a hyperinflation. And suddenly they start looking not just at Japan, but at other countries, and they discover that we are better, but not that much better. So my point is that at some point the market forces, will come in and they'll start sending interest rates, and I guess
it's going to happen. Everybody knows that the rates that we currently have and the things that are going on around the world, the amount of debt that Japan has is unsustainable. By the way, by every metric possible.
That's right.
But yet at the same time, and the effectiveness of some of their actions, look at what happened after they went negative with the yen. The yen is, it clipped 98 not too long ago. I mean, it's now at whatever, 103. What, 101, 102. But, you see the same thing happening with the euro. You know, the euro obviously spiked also after they went negative. So this is all backfiring. But I guess we're still at a point that there's a lot of euphoria out there. Let's switch over to a couple of names. Give me an example. You and I have talked about Amgen, your last writing in The Contrarian Edge that you have. You talk about Amgen. You switched out of one stock to another. I know a while back, way back, this is something that's just hitting my head, is you were a big advocate of Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah.
And I was, I think IBM too. Was it IBM or just Hewlett-Packard?
No, Hewlett-Packard.
Just Hewlett-Packard. And I was always like, God, that company looks like crap. I'm not suggesting you were wrong or right about it. I was just always wondering, what were you seeing? What are you looking at in these companies that are saying, hey, this is really a great value orientation? So let's skip ahead to Amgen, which is something that you've recently said, hey, I like the stock.
Well, actually, let me make it easier for you. You brought up Hewlett-Packard. Let me just bring up a more topical company, Apple, just because the numbers are fresh in my head. I think it's just Apple, we look at Apple and we say, okay, so their iPhone sales were down 15% this quarter, and I think last quarter, and probably down another 15% this quarter. And the market says, "Oh my God, this company, their iPhone sales, Apple is down. iPhone sales are going to decline for a long period of time." Okay, and they're drawing straight lines. Okay, the way we look at Apple, we say, "Okay, let's say, if you look at what happened to iPhone sales last year, they were up 50%.
Right.
They introduced iPhone 6, that was very popular. the sales went up on like, basically almost 50% or 40-something percent. So what Apple did basically, it stole its sales from a few years, from 2016 to 2017 sales. Mm-hmm. Okay, so once you have this insight, you say, okay, so what is the Apple's earnings power? So what we did in our analysis, in our financial models, we took Apple sales down 15% this year and down 15% next year. So it will be down 30%.
Right.
Also, we grew its R&D by 25% each year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in this case, we still get earnings of $6.50. Okay. So if you put it, 10 times multiple on that, you get $65 stock.
Right.
They're going to have $25 roughly of net cash. So you have a $90 stock just if they don't come out with a single new product ever again. If it's just iPhone sales.
Right.
Okay. But they're spending $10 billion in R&D. Okay. Actually, next year it's going to be close to 12. That money is not going on iPhone. It's going on something else.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not basically at today's price, for the most part, you're not paying for future creativity at all. And I'm assuming that iPhone basically, will stagnate and shrink and start shrinking, which in the long run, Apple is still taking market share from, globally. And India, in India, iPhone market share is almost, is non-existent. And that's a huge next market. And so that's kind of so what we try to do first, we try to kill the company. And if we can't kill it, then it becomes a very interesting situation for us. So in case of Apple, we try to kill it and we just can't.
Yeah. No, I hear you on Apple. I mean, that Apple is one of the names that
we... And I feel back, it was a, this was just a while back, and we did something very similar. We ran through our models and said, and tried to kill its sales. And we just couldn't, and that's why it was an attractive opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Similar situation as biotechs would be Gilead today.
Yep.
We basically tried to kill the company, and we can't. And actually, very similar to say, our mental thinking on this is very similar to Apple. Gilead makes I'm oversimplifying it, two drugs. HIV drug. Today, if you have HIV, you basically... It's not going to change your lifestyle. You'll be taking Gilead drug, and you're going to feel absolutely fine. But you have to take the drugs for the rest of your life.
Right.
So that HIV business is growing by maybe 5 or 6% a year, very stable growing business, and it earns today roughly about, let's say, just to make the math simple, about $4. It's like $3.70, but let's say $4. They also created they have a hepatitis C drug, where basically It's phenomenal because they cure hepatitis C.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. The cure is really cool. That was out, I think, about two years ago? Yeah.
Exactly. But what's interesting about this, when the cure came out, a lot of patients who had hepatitis C were waiting for the drug. So the sales of that drug jumped to $20 billion, which is insane. Just $20 billion of sales.
Right.
And since then, they declined to $15 billion. So the analysts seeing... declined from $20 billion to 15, and they kind of start, drawing lines. Okay, it's going down to 10. But more importantly, hepatitis C is kind of a weird animal because once you take a drug for 5 weeks and it cures you, which is a great thing for a patient, but from the business model perspective, not so good, right?
Right.
Because every time
if you cure the disease, you eradicate the disease. There's no more need for your drug.
Exactly. So the way we approached it, we said, okay, how many patients are sick in the United States? There are 3 million patients. Okay, if you make assumptions what the how much revenue they make per patient, we make assumption of how many patients they're gonna, what percentage of those patients they're gonna cure, and then we go, country by country, and we estimate that the value of hepatitis C is over $100 a share. So the profits that Gilead will make over time from hepatitis C is worth more than the stock today.
Hmm.
Okay?
Right.
So I wrote this article, which I wanted to title, Buy Hepatitis C, Get AIDS for Free. Okay, the editor did not go for it.
No.
That's basically, but in reality,
right,
that's our analytical framework. You're basically not paying for hepatitis, for AIDS drug when you're buying hepatitis C. And another way to look at it is this, Gilead takes every dollar of free cash flow generates and it basically pay dividend and buy back stock. So if they just take this money and continue to do this, and let's say in 5 or 6 years they eradicate hepatitis C, then the share count declines so much that the value of HIV drugs would be about $8 or $9 a share.
You know, it's interesting you bring up this whole idea of share count reduction, which I think has something a little bit to do with the lack of volumes in markets these days. But that's a side note. Are you a big fan of buyback programs?
When they make sense. Like, I think Gilead right now generates a lot of cash flows. As a management, they have several choices. They can do nothing, so the cash will accumulate. They can buy another company, or they can buy back stock if the stock is cheap. Well, this is a company that's trading at 6 or 7 times earnings, so I would argue the stock is cheap. So for them, it's rational to buy every share they can put their hands on without leveraging the company.
It seems to me that I get that, and it does increase their overall EPS and all that, but it would seem that they'd want to also look out there to find other companies, maybe small companies, that have and even often drug type of deals, something where they can find potential growth and opportunity for the future to expand their entire base of offerings rather than just buy back their own stock.
Andrew, it's kind of funny you say this. The story of Gilead is that, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, they paid $11 billion for a company called Pharma Asset that had a stage 2 drug. And everybody looked at it and said, these guys are insane. Seriously, $11 billion for a company that had zero revenues and had one drug in stage 2. That was the hepatitis C drug, right? Mm-hmm. And that probably ended up being one of the best investments ever in corporate history, right? Because just last year, sales were $20 billion. But my point is, what I'm trying to say is, they should only make acquisitions of other companies if it makes economic sense.
Right?
They should not, if they think they can buy a stream of cash flows, future cash flows, that will, create $1 billion of free cash flows over time, then guess what? They should pay $600 million for that.
Right.
But they should not pay $2 or $3 billion for that just to do something. And that's all I'm trying to say.
Let me get back to something. You mentioned approximately, it will fluctuate over time and all that, but there's approximately 25% equity exposure in your portfolios now, and you're comfortable with that because you're comfortable with the stocks that you own. I mean, how many stocks does that spread over?
So our deal portfolio would have maybe 20 to 30 stocks. Mm-hmm. Today we have some positions are smaller because we buy half position and the stock runs up on us, so we never get a chance to buy the second half.
Yeah.
So we have today we may have a 10 positions and it's a 20%, maybe less than that, but maybe 8 positions and we have 20-25% invested. Right. Our existing accounts that have been with us for a while are 50% invested. So a lot of the stocks are, in their portfolio would be, they're not buys, but they're not sells either. So kind of they're in between.
Right.
But I want to stress a very important point. I am not trying to time the market.
Right. No, I get it.
I'm really just looking for to find high quality companies at good prices, and I can't. I think that's, and we look globally. We don't just look in United States.
Right. No, I hear you. No, the same thing. I mean, the fact is that what comes through our screens and our analysis and our reviews, it's disconcerting that there are so few stocks in that level. One of the things that I'm concerned about is, you mentioned the Apple situation, where if you look at Apple stole the revenues and sales and earnings due to the iPhone 6 and iPhone 6S and all that. What my concern is, we're going to hit the backside of a different situation, which is that we had a slowdown and earnings were slowing down, we know, for about 6 quarters or so now. And now all of a sudden we may see the other side where there's at least not a slowdown in earnings growth, maybe even an uptick, but that's on a very low base because we had so many quarters of lower numbers. And that may be a catalyst that you get to see all these sell side guys on TV saying, hey, look, earnings are growing. Mm-hmm. But we're still not going to be in any better situation.
Well, because the valuations are already high, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, that this is what makes it so difficult, because I'm fine to accept lower growth if I can buy something cheap enough. Because, you know, but the you know, there's very little growth and stocks are very expensive. So this is why, you know, this is why I end up basically holding so much cash.
Right. I got
it's you. It could be a very frustrating environment if you're just, you know, seriously, we just turn a lot of rocks and can't find anything.
Yeah, and I hear you. No, I hear you. And then, you know, when you do, it's obviously a good time, obviously, but then that may be when the markets come back a little bit, and then you have the price target of, let's say, 15 on something, where it's currently trading at, I'm just taking a number, 22, and you got to buy at a much lower level, which is like, wow, I like it at this number. Yeah, I really like it at this number, but man, what's going on with this company? You know what I'm saying? As long as all the analysis stays true, and they continue doing what they're doing, and markets, for whatever reason or another. And this is the big difference, by the way, with technical versus fundamental analysis. It's a much different situation. It's a longer-term situation. It's a much more patient situation. You know, but I think that it's obviously very, very viable. We're going to end it here. You can check out all the information over on Contrarian Edge, or go to imausa.com and find out more about Vitaly and what he has to say and offer and all that. And we'll get you back on soon. I appreciate you coming aboard.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Awesome. Thanks for talking. Now, as I mentioned before, we started talking with Vitaly that I had this opportunity to spend some time with Larry Williams. He's been on the show several times, and if you haven't heard of him, he's one of the greats. He's written several books. He's got a great piece that he puts out annually with his annual predictions, which is interestingly accurate. What I mean by that is he goes through seasonality, he goes through cycles, and he comes up with this whole outward look in November or December of the year, and he looks at what is the following year, the next 12 months, what it's going to bring, and invests his portfolios, his own personal money too, with that in mind. In other words, he doesn't change the inputs throughout the year. So he looks at the seasonality, he looks at the various cycles, he looks at all sorts of different things, and he comes up with a chart. And I saw some of this, and I was pretty blown away with some of the interesting accuracy of his last several years. I've followed him for a long time, of course. And next year's what it's going to look like. Now, a couple things I want to tell you, a little takeaway from this meeting that I thought was really interesting. Now, first of all, I'll mention that one of the things that I saw was that he said was he's still bullish. That right now in the near term, any weakness he would be a buyer of. But he's concerned about September. According to his predictive models, September looks like it could have some downturn with some interesting magnitude. I'm not talking about a crash, but I'm talking about a downturn in the markets in the month of September. Now that ties out with a few of the other things that I'm seeing here when it looks outside of our own indicators. You know, we look at Tom McClellan, we look at the Spearman, where it's going, we look at the situation that Larry Williams is talking about, we look at the VIX buying that I talked about earlier in the show, and that's kind of interesting that we're looking at this, and add to the fact that we also have a Fed that, while we know they're extremely dovish, could actually do something in September. And finally, right before the election, a couple months before the election, all this ties out as very interesting information to use to keep in the background to see, in fact, if we are seeing that the all-time highs and new highs in stocks are starting to turn over and we're seeing divergences and bearish divergences in markets, and if, in fact, some of these predictive models work, et cetera, something to keep in mind. Then he also talked about 2017. And I thought this was really interesting. He talked about how 2017 could be potentially a very bad year. There's some presidential cycle issues that are going on there. But also what he mentioned, what I thought was really weird and interesting, I never really thought about this before, was years that end in 7 are often bad. You think about the various years, like 2007, 1987, right, you go back in time, 67, 2000, I think it was 1927, You go back all these different years and you look at all the years that end in seven, and generally speaking, they're not good. So when you bring up the seasonality factors when it comes to equities, I thought it was really an interesting way of looking at things from just a seasonality. Now, once something is known and once a cycle is well identified, it usually never happens again. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. He also talked about how difficult it is to call market tops, but how easy from a technical analyst side of things, we use various indicators, whether it's a MACD or an RSI or stochastics or whatever else you're using, it's much easier to call a market bottom. One thing he likes to look at in looking for a market top is something very much new to his process, a few years, but something that he said he couldn't believe that when he saw this, how right it was. Now, I'm just throwing this out there, not saying I'm totally in line with this, but I'm just telling you, I'm just giving you some information of what he said. And he said that he watches employment. And in particular, what he watches is a 12-month moving average of the employment numbers. A 12-month moving average of the employment numbers. And when the current rate of employment, so it's the unemployment rate we're talking about here. So the 12-month moving average of the unemployment rate. When the unemployment rate moves above that 12-month moving average, that's a time to get concerned. So right now it's still under because it's been coming down on the unemployment rate, of course. But something to keep in consideration. Now, the other thing that's more important than that is you couple that with recessions. Now, I think we all know this, but anyway, it was interesting because he painted bars on a chart that showed when recessions happen and when the unemployment rate started moving higher, which happens during recessions. And you saw that stocks started to move lower right after the official call, when, you know, quote unquote, the official call that we are in a recession, not just the banter. I mean, the official government call that, hey, we are in a recession. We've had those two consecutive quarters of negative growth, blah, 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 all that stuff. So we get to the negative, we get to the report that we are in a recession. That's a time to bail on stocks until you get that technical indicator that shows we're at a market bottom. So I think that was really interesting. You combine all that together. So one of the things that we're going to watch is right now, we're going to watch the plot, the 12-month moving average of the unemployment rate. Watch for it to turn if it turns, and then look for the official call of a recession if that ever happens. I'm not saying it's happening, but if it ever happens. And also on top of it all, keep in mind, let's kind of think back at this, maybe jot this down, that we saw a lot of converging discussions about September being a concerning month from a downturn of markets. And on top of that, that 2017 could be a negative year, or not a good year for markets, because it just so happens to be the year that ends in seven. So just put those down somewhere, maybe put in your calendar, like in 6 months, and or maybe in 3 months and 6 months from now, take a look at that and see if any of those things came true. I'm going to kind of take a look at that. I'll mark it down as well, just to see how interesting these cycles can work and how repeatable they may be, the accuracy of these cycles. Just something to think about. Anyway, we're going to end it here. If you have any questions, of course, you can write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll mention to you, you should be also listening to DH Unplugged each and every week. Myself and John C. Dvorak have a great show. I mean, a really great show. If you haven't listened to DH Unplugged yet, you're missing a lot. There are a lot of things we do on there, like the DH Unplugged Old Codgers versus Millennial Portfolio. We have the Closest to the Pin competition each and every week, and the Closest to the Pin Cup for the end of the year, where you win prizes if you're closest to the price of prediction on a stock. We also have the, what else was it? Close to the Pin. Oh, and the Weekly Stock Picks. Something very interesting. Go over to dhunplugged.com and check that out, and make sure to listen and tell some friends about it. Why don't you? Anyway, thanks for listening. What else can I say? Have a great end of the summer. I'll see you next week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.